In part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Learn about Krannert Center's 2006-2007 performance season with guest artists Sonny Rollins, Alfred Brendel, and the Martha Graham Dance Company by visiting KrannertCenter.com or browsing a season brochure.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. The poet Edward Hirsch says, "Poetry is a means of exchange, a form of reciprocity, a magic to be shared, a gift. There has never been a civilization without it." And now, thanks to her latest project, arts journalist Rebecca Presson Mosby offers us an opportunity to share in the magic, the gift of poetry. She has produced a boxed set of CDs featuring 98 poets reading their work. Their voices come to us on four CDs, voices that take us back to the 19th century and the beginning of sound recording, up to today. Let me name some of the poets in this collection, which is called Poetry on Record, 98 Poets Read Their Work, 1888 to 2006. Alfred Lord Tennyson, Walt Whitman, Carl Sandburg, Gertrude Stein, Robert Frost, Gwendolyn Brooks, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Mark Strand, and Rita Dove. The recordings also come with a companion book that contains an essay by poet Al Young and our guest this afternoon, Rebecca Presson Mosby. We'll talk with her today about poetry and listen to a sampling of poems from Poetry on Record. And listeners, we also invite you to join us this afternoon. We look forward to your telephone calls, your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Now, if you're outside Champaign-Urbana, use the toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. As Rebecca Presson, she hosted the weekly public radio program New Letters on the Air from 1983 to 1995. While producing and hosting the program featuring poets and writers, she also worked for NPR member station KCUR as a news host and arts reporter. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Rebecca Presson Mosby, it's so good to talk with you. Hello.
Hello, Celeste. It's good to talk with you.
You know, I very much like Ed Hirsch's poetry and his writing about poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a guest with us last week, and he said that he makes discoveries about poetry by writing about poetry. And I wonder, as you worked on this project, did you find things that surprised you, that offered you new insights into poetry?
Well, in the writing process, throughout, yes, but in the writing process also, he's right, because when I started to write this essay, I read my old essay for In Their Own Voices, which was a box set that preceded this one. And I sort of read it, and I thought, well, I'm not going to do any better than this. I think I'll just copy it. And then as I started writing, I realized, oh, yeah, there's a whole lot more to be said. There are all kinds of new things that I've learned and discovered since starting to work on Poetry on Record. And so, yeah, it ended up being a very exciting process and a process of discovery, as Ed said.
Yeah, and also, you know, writing about it is one thing, but then listening to the poets, it's very instructive, and it's a wonderful experience as well.
Yes, and that's what takes you back to the really primal nature of poetry. As we all know, but we don't always practice, poetry was an oral art form before, thousands of years before writing existed. So when you listen to a poem, you're partaking of a very ancient tradition and the original tradition of poetry and getting back to its roots, which doesn't mean you shouldn't read poems. It just means that you're having a sort of historical and direct contact with the poet and the poem.
Yeah. Well, let's jump right in. I thought we would begin with Gwendolyn Brooks.
Great.
We Real Cool. What would you like to say by way of introduction to this recording?
Well, she has an introduction that's really great. I'll mm-hmm. only add this much. I did have the pleasure once at New Letters of interviewing Gwen Brooks. And what she told me about this poem is that we should notice that there's a we at the line ending at each line. So it's we real cool, we, you know, at the end. And she said the reason she put those we's at the ends of all the lines was to direct attention to these young men and to sort of add dignity to their existence.
Okay, here's we real cool.
I wrote this poem because I passed by a pool hall in my community in Chicago. I saw inside this pool room a bunch, as I say in the poem, of seven youngsters shooting pool during school time. And instead of saying to myself, why aren't they in school? I said to myself, I wonder how they feel about themselves. It seemed to me that they would want to thumb their noses at the establishment. And I used the month of June as my establishment symbol, because that's non-controversial. Everybody loves June. So if they thought about these matters in any conceptual way, they would want to jazz June. This poem was banned because of the word jazz, which was understood to be a sexual reference. That was not my intention, though I have no objection if it helps anybody. But I was thinking of music. The pool players, seven at the golden shuffle. We real cool, we left school, we lurk late, we strike straight, we sing sin, we thin gin, we jazz June, we die soon.
Gwendolyn Brooks, We Real Cool.
It's amazing how a little short poem like that can have such an impact.
And I just love the way she says it.
The way she, yeah.
Yeah, and I also have to congratulate you on how you present that form in visual in the companion book.
Oh, boy, I didn't do that, but I'm so pleased with it. Yeah, I just love what the design team did in terms of turning the poems into works of art.
Yeah. I guess what I mean is you and your collaborators.
Yeah, me and my collaborators.
Yeah.
It was my idea to use the poems as the artwork, but believe me, I didn't make them look like this.
They didn't.
I was thrilled when I saw them. I was hoping they'd make poetry postcards out of these.
Oh, that's a terrific idea.
I think so, too.
I want to explain or describe this, and maybe you can also follow through here on this as well. But this poem is set out like it appears on a blackboard.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, they just do different things with all the different poems, like William Carlos Williams, The Red Wheelbarrow. It looks like it's on wallpaper, you know, and they're really varied. And I love the way they do the Whitman, where they make it look like it's a math problem. I think that's very cool, too.
Yeah.
But they're all different, and they're just beautiful.
Yeah. Well, back to Gwendolyn Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
In your essay that accompanies the recordings, you quote her as saying, poetry is life distilled.
That's my favorite definition of poetry. I think she really got it. And think about that. Think about this poem. I think it takes 17 seconds to read this poem, and I forget how many words it is, but it's not very many words. And yet, don't you feel like you have a real picture of these kids, of their life and what they're about and what their likely fate is, just
mm-hmm.
in those few words?
Mm-hmm. We real cool, we.
Yeah.
Yeah. In her introduction, she spoke about censorship.
Right. Isn't that funny?
Isn't that interesting?
The word jazz.
Jazz.
Well, and of course, we don't have Howell included here, but we do have Ginsberg and his publisher, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who had to fight a big lawsuit over a poem, over the poem Howell, which was brought up on obscenity charges. And we can be grateful that, you know, justice prevailed and Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti won. But it is amazing that poetry and words can have such power.
Yeah, and I'm sorry to say that we cannot air some of these poems.
Yeah.
We can't put them on the radio.
Well, man, I guess that means people just have to go buy them.
Well, there's a bright side there. But at the same time, it is, you know, I had to make sure that I listened. There was so much I wanted to play. I mean, there's so many wonderful poems here. But, for example, we couldn't play Suji Kwak Kim.
Yeah, and it does seem silly not to be able to play that. Yeah, it's, you know, just because you use graphic language doesn't, I mean, she's describing something horrible that happened, so.
How did you decide what to include and what to leave out? I mean, the choices are just...
Oh, it's overwhelming, and you lose a lot of sleep. And in the end, what I was really trying to do was not to say, okay, these are the 128 best poems by the 98 best poets who were ever recorded, because that's ridiculous. And if you did that, then you'd be afraid of young people like Suji Kwak Kim, because, well, she's got one book, you know. I mean, that's, we don't know that yet how she's going to turn out as a poet, but we do know that she has some wonderful poems, and we know this is a wonderful poem. So in the end, what I was really trying to do was simply to give a real, as complete as possible, a presentation of what has occurred in poetry since the advent of recording technology in 1888, that would be at Thomas Edison's phonograph, which was then a wax cylinder that was recorded on. So you have poems that date back to the mid-19th century by Tennyson and Browning. And then I just wanted to go through all the stages. I wanted to represent the big movements in poetry, such as modernism, Harlem Renaissance, Black Arts Movement, New Formalism, you know, all that kind of thing. And then I also wanted to look at different themes in poetry. I wanted to kind of cover the various wars, love poems, death poems, odes, ars poetica. You get the idea.
Yeah.
So the individual poems are mainly in service of the whole, although there are, of course, poems that you absolutely have to have because they're anthems, they're things we all know and love, such as We Real Cool. But also, you know, Robert Frost, The Road Not Taken, Dorothy Parker Reading Resume, that kind of stuff, you know, just stuff that we kind of grew up with, and I think we all just would feel bereft if it weren't
there.
Yeah,
1888 to 2006, has the style of performing poetry changed?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the other, you know, this is about history as much. It's about the history of recording technology, the history of performance, poetry performance, and the history of actual poetry. I hope, all in one. And, of course, when you go back to these old guys, when you hear Tennyson and Browning, for example, they were accustomed to performing. They were very popular already by the time they were recorded, and they would attract huge crowds, and they would have to orate. They would have to reach back to the back row in the upper balcony, and so they had this oratorical style that you can hear in their recordings. And they were old men when these recordings were made, and this was brand new technology. And Browning is so excited about it that he just keeps thanking Mr. Edison for him losing his mind, you know. but in any event, you can see, you know, where they were coming from at that point in time. Then when you get to Yeats, who's sort of after the 19th century guys, he's the first 20th century poet, He has a very definite idea.
He sure does.
About how he wants to read.
Yeah, I thought we would play that introduction to the poem he reads.
Yeah, he explains it very well.
And he is very certain and very secure and very sure of himself. And this is the poet W.B. Yeats introducing his poem, The Lake of Innisfree.
I'm going to read my poems with great emphasis upon their rhythm. And that may seem strange if you are not used to it. I remember the great English poet, William Morris, coming in a rage out of some lecture hall where somebody had recited a passage out of his Sigurd of Alstom. It gave me a devil of a lot of trouble, said Morris, to get that thing into verse. It gave me the devil of a lot of trouble to get into verse the poems that I am going to read. And that is why I will not read them as if they were prose.
I will not read them as if they were prose.
And Seamus Heaney very accurately, I think, describes Yeats's method of reading as an elevated chant.
Hmm. Yeah.
So you go from there, you know, and then you go through, I think, a lot of Americans who try to sound British or even in the case of Ezra Pound, Irish. Pound, for all the world, sounds Irish despite his Haley, Idaho birthright.
Isn't that amazing?
Isn't that funny? I think it's hilarious, frankly.
Yeah. But it also suggests that the love of performance as well as the love of poetry.
And also the effect that the friendship had. You know, we read that Yeats was affected by Pound because Pound was really the Young Turk of that time. He founded the Imagist and he founded this Imagist magazine and all this stuff. But then when we hear Pound read, we realize it really ran the other direction too because he's very clearly influenced by Yeats' reading.
Yeah. I also was thought that I heard that kind of theatricality in the recordings of Dylan Thomas that you've included here.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, Dylan Thomas, though, came later. He was after the modernists, so he was a little bit of a throwback.
Right.
Getting up there reading that way in the 50s. But it really, it worked. You know, he was a bit of a rock star. He was back, you know, on the level with people like Tennyson and Browning, who were tremendously popular figures in their time.
Why do you think some poets catch on kind of in that rock star way?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question, because you have like people like Kerouac who had that appeal too. Ginsberg had it. Sometimes there's an energy. It's just, I guess, it's an energy level that is sort of irresistible.
Yeah.
And Dylan Thomas absolutely had it. I think some of it, you know, some of these people had it later. You know, like now, I think we feel that way about, say, Langston Hughes. But Gwen Brooks had a big following in her lifetime. Mm. Bukowski had a huge following.
Carl Sandburg leaps to mind.
Right, and Sandburg was a singer, of course, as well as a poet, and that's where you get the musicality in his performance, I think, from the fact, well, that he was Swedish, or he originally spoke Swedish, was his first language, and he was a singer, and all those things, I think, really come through in the way that he reads.
Yeah. Was Dorothy Parker popular in her day?
She was, but she was well known because she was writing for Vanity Fair and she was in the Algonquin Roundtable and she was on TV some. So yeah, she was known, but I'm not aware of her having big audiences as far as poetry readings go. But don't you think Dorothy Parker is the absolute perfect, all-time perfect blend of voice and poem?
Yeah. And she is so sharp.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what led you to include her?
I wanted to include, I admire her in the sense that she and Edna St. Vincent Millay were these new women, and they both They were both remarkable women for their time. I mean, they were women who really went their own way at a time in history when that was really quite rare. And also, because I wanted to have stuff that was fun. You know, there are a lot of poems here there's a fair amount of light verse because I think, you know, we need to have some fun. It's entertaining to listen to even, in a sense, it's entertaining to listen to any well-written and well-read poem. But once in a while, I think we want to lighten the mood, too.
Yeah. Well, should we hear Resume?
Oh, sure. Everybody has fun listening to this, I think.
Okay.
Resume. Razors pain you, rivers are damp, acids stain you, and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't lawful, nooses give, gas smells awful. You might as well live.
Dorothy Parker, Resume.
I think maybe she's had a little whiskey and cigarettes in her day.
Yeah.
That voice is so great, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon is arts journalist Rebecca Preston Mosby. We're talking with her this afternoon about her latest project. It is a set of CDs, a boxed set of four CDs featuring 98 poets reading their work. It's called Poetry on Record. 98 poets read their work, 1888 to 2006. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Your telephone calls are invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL, 333-WILL. In the book that comes with Poetry on Record, you quote William Maxwell.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I don't think of the meaning of poems as much as pleasure, as if I were listening to Schubert, whose phrases move my heart. Poems are pure music. Poets are possessed. That's why it appeals to me."
That's beautiful. I heard him say that on PBS.
Really?
Yeah. And so I, you know, Googled it and copied it down because it just hit me, right? Then yes, that's what this is all about, and I especially think that quote is relevant when you're listening to something like the modernists. When you listen to somebody like Eliot, now in this poem they get to the Magi, you can pretty well follow it. But in something like the Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, you hear these words kind of clanging around, and you don't get them. And of course, I think this has been the bane of poetry in the late 20th century, was that everybody sat around spending all the time to figuring out what all those words meant, you know, rather than just loving them and enjoying them.
Yeah, it's so fun to have them in your mouth.
Yeah, or your head, yeah.
Yeah, and speak them, yeah.
Yeah, and it, there's nothing wrong with trying to figure them out, but I think you never want to get away from the pleasure of listening to poetry and listening to the music of poetry. And I think Maxwell just hit it right on the head.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Edgar County on line 4. Hi.
Good afternoon. Did you know that Robert Frost appeared at the University of Illinois in 1960?
I don't doubt it. There were about 50 recordings of Frost in the Library of Congress, and he was very popular in the end of his life and did a lot of readings, yeah.
Cantankerous, but popular.
Yeah.
And
yeah, the lovable Kirk Curmudgeon, huh?
Yes. And the interesting quote that he made, I got to meet him that evening.
Oh, lucky you.
And he gave a two-line poem, which I've never seen in print.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've even searched for it on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote it on the back of a check stub, so I know it exists. You know, it's not a memory thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, "Dear God, forgive the little jokes I've played on you, and I'll forgive the great big one you played on me." And I think that was kind of how he took life.
Well, I guess you I don't know. I'm not sure you can play any jokes on God.
Well, I think he thought he did.
Maybe.
And also John Ciardi once told me that they were at a conference at Sugarloaf, you know, or Breadloaf, what is it, in Vermont?
Breadloaf, uh-huh.
Breadloaf.
And I would say that Carl Sandburg, while he wrote some very nice poetry, mm-hmm. was more of a promoter of his work. His wife was assiduous in his promotion. And anyway, they were at this reception, Ciardi and Frost.
Oh, huh?
And
I knew Ciardi. I didn't know Frost.
Well, John Ciardi was just a marvelous critic.
And not a bad poet either.
No, but not a, I would not say an A-line. You know, of course, we're getting into, you know, discussion of, you know, where people rank. But anyway, they were at this reception. And on the other side of the room, in comes Sandburg.
Oh, my.
And
it was a momentous occasion.
Yes. Huh? And Frost turned to Ciardi and said, well, if it isn't the swab of the plains.
Oh, that's nasty.
Yes.
My goodness. Well, you know, I do have a poet friend who told me that when he was young, he went to a Frost reading, and Frost refused to sign his book because it was a paperback. So.
Well, that's possible.
So
and also Allen Ginsberg.
A little dismissive.
Pretty chilly.
Yeah.
Allen Ginsberg was an interesting person.
Uh-huh.
And to see him in his readings, and he went through a transition from wearing the tie-dyed.
He went through from the Beats to the hippies to the.
Yeah, the three-piece suit.
And then he went through that phase, like what did he play, a zither? Is that right?
Well, he had these little finger cymbals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That he also played. But yet at the same time, it was fascinating to watch him, you know,
as far as the little bit that I knew him, he was a very sweet person. He seemed like a really nice guy.
I want to thank the listener for his anecdotes.
Thanks for the little Frost poem.
Yeah, and the anecdotes as well. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455.
And I don't want to speak behind your caller's back, but Sandburg did do the work. He wrote songs. He was also a biographer, of course. He won Pulitzer Prize for his Lincoln biography. He wrote several biographies of Lincoln. So he was sort of a jack of all trades. He didn't settle with any one thing, and I think certainly Frost is a much greater poet than Sandburg is. But yeah. I certainly wouldn't think of Sandburg as a dilettante.
Yeah, well, one of the things about Sandburg is you know, he, I think you note this in the companion book, he was a politician.
Mm-hmm. Very political, and his poems are very political.
Yes. And there are many political poems in this collection. And some we cannot play on the radio. But one we can is Carl Sandburg.
Right.
And why don't we take this opportunity to hear Carl.
Great.
Out of the people, yes, perhaps I could offer a passage that consists entirely of proverbs, some of them older than the alphabet, others as recent, as modern as the oxygen tent, the bombing plane, the vacuum cleaner, the CIO, the sit-down strike, and the mediation board. The people, yes. The people pause for breath. For wounds and bruises to heal, for food again, after war, after famine. people is a monolith, a mover, a dirt farmer, a desperate hoper. The prize liar comes saying, I know how, listen to me, I'll bring you through. The guesser comes saying, the way is long and hard, and maybe what I offer will work out. The people choose, and the people's choice, more often than not, is one more washout. Yet the strong man, the priceless one who wants nothing for himself and has his roots among his people, comes often enough for the people to know him and to win through into gains beyond later losing. Comes often enough so the people can look back and say, we have come far and we will go farther yet. The people is a trunk of patience. A monolith. What is history but a few big names plus people? What is a big name unless the people love it or hate it for what it did to them or for them while it was in the going? And this big name means pretense and plunder, ashes and dung, while another is armfuls of roses enshrined beyond speech. You may call spirits from the vasty deep. Aye, you may. But will they come when you call them? You may sell an idea to the people and sit back satisfied you have them your way, but will they stay sold on the idea? Will they be easy to hold in line unless the idea has a promise of roots twisted deep in the heart of man, being brought into play as though justice between man and man may yet breeze across the world with sea smells and a very old, a very plain homemade cry. Why didn't we think of this before?
Carl Sandburg from The People, yes, number 90. It has to be, it works today.
Yeah, he was probably the first poet, certainly in the disc one, to be really comfortable with the microphone. He really knows how to milk it and how to use it, and he also understood the value of changing a poem for his audience. In Poetry Speaks, the book that I did with three CDs before this one. He has a poem in which he makes contemporary additions to his poems, you know, and changes the names of it's a World War I poem, and he puts references from World War II in because he's recording it in the 50s, and you know, just sort of makes little and adds women with where the poem says men, he'll add women, and he just does little touches like that that I don't think too many people thought of at that time in history. Mm. So he was a performer at heart.
Yeah. It's interesting to see and to think about poets continually revising work. So many of them do.
That's right. Like Galway Connell, this version of After Making Love, We Hear Footsteps. I don't know which version. You know, every book he puts it in, he changes it. And yeah. Of course, that goes back to Whitman, who changed the Leaves of Grass.
Leaves of Grass, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mentioned Suji Kwak Kim earlier. She was a guest on this program maybe a year ago, and I had her book, and she did some readings, and she changed the poems as she...
She did that. In fact, I think she did that for this poem, too. I had photocopied the poem for her to read. I recorded her in a studio in Albany, and she took it and marked it all up and made a number of changes, Fragments of the Forgotten War, it's called, about her father's involvement in the Korean War. She's imagining her father in the Korean War. But yeah, she changed it considerably from the way it was published in the book.
Yeah. She was a really very thoughtful young woman.
Yeah, she was really took to that microphone, too. She really just understood exactly what I wanted and how to do it.
Yeah.
Really, she was phenomenal.
You've interviewed so many poets now. You've recorded them reading their poetry. Mm-hmm. Who are some of the poets you've worked with that are most memorable?
There are more. There are many. I have, we could sit up and do Poe gossip all night long, which I have done on occasion. But the first poet I ever interviewed was Denise Levertov, if you can imagine. And I was very lucky because I was not educated in poetry. My education is in theater. I sort of stumbled into poetry, and happily, she was very kind and very gracious. And it was just, a thrill to sit there in the studio and have a private reading. And so that's kind of what these discs are all about. But we were mentioning Ginsberg earlier. I think Ginsberg's come up several times. The interview with Ginsberg was fascinating. It turned out to be a very poor recording. I don't know. Something was wrong with the electricity in the hotel room we were recording in, I guess. But it was fascinating because as we were talking, you were saying this all goes around back to what you said earlier, too, about not being able to play some of the poems. He started getting very exercised. We were talking about Howell and the trial, and he started to get exercised about a recent incident of censorship where one of his poems was on a radio program, and he got a call from somebody finding out that they'd pulled the plug in the middle of the poem. Well, it turned out that he was talking about, I almost never did this, but on one occasion I took some poems from LPs, from old poetry LPs, and one of them was Ginsberg's recording of Bird Brain, and I played it on New Letters on the Air, which was aired on about 50 affiliate stations. And the poem did not have any of these words in it, but it was suggestive in the way, in the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so apparently one of the affiliate stations decided it was unsuitable for children. But anyway, it was just the most amazing thing because you're having this conversation with Allen Ginsberg. And I didn't know anything about this incident, that nobody from the station called me or said anything to me. Apparently they just did it. And so in the course of this conversation with Allen Ginsberg, you learn that he's talking about your program.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was really an amazing thing. And then that conversation ended up being published. And the tape wasn't good, but the conversation was published in Harper's Magazine. So, that ended up being interesting, too.
Yeah.
I could kind of go on and on. It's really fun when I used to go to a lot of writers' workshops, too, and then you get to spend several days or a week with the poets and get to know them socially as well as professionally. And it's interesting.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Marshall, line 4. Hi.
Hi. I've heard that Carl Sandburg helped dedicate the Assembly Hall in May of 1963.
Here at the University of Illinois.
Yes. Hmm. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. My mother and father were there, and I was actually in utero with my mother. And she told me that. They always told me that ever since I was growing up, that they saw Carl Sandburg. They let him out, and he said a few words, and no one could really hear. Then they let him back out.
Well,
I just
saw him, huh?
Yeah, yeah. I guess he's that's why you could say he always had a special connection to Illinois.
Oh, of course he did. Yeah, he's a Chicago guy, an Illinois guy all the way, yeah.
Okay.
That's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And another listener is waiting for us this afternoon in Mill Creek Valley, line 1. Hi.
Yeah, afternoon. How's it going?
Fine. How are you?
Well, it could be worse. I just got in about, that's 2:30 our time in Indiana. Is she talking about just a wide range of poets?
Yes.
Okay. I was interested, I guess she's made a lot of recordings, too. And poets are not always very good readers of their own poetry. Mm-hmm. I liked a lot of Frost's poetry, but his readings, I used to play some recordings in schools, and to me they were quite stilted. But Sandburg, on the other hand, was very interesting. I suppose it was maybe a Swedish accent, but I think especially of the one about grass.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, could you turn it up a little bit? And he would, you probably heard the recording, but I could go, pile the bodies high. You know, his voice is rising.
That's the one I was referring to earlier when I said he changed some of the names.
And then, shovel them under and let them work. Really putting this.
Yeah, it's great.
Struggle into it. And
that one's on Poetry Speaks.
He was good at that. I'm too old-fashioned. I don't like free verse a whole lot, and I still like Longfellow and Tennyson, a lot of what they did, too.
Well, Tennyson, you know, was recorded, and Tennyson is included here. Longfellow's a little too early, but there is a recording of Tennyson reading The Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah. The poems that we've played this afternoon, the poets reading them, saying them, performing them.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a marvelous job, but there are some poets here who you're kind of surprised.
It's a good and it's a valid point, but my feeling is that whether or not you think the poet reads the poem well,
mm-hmm.
you still, by hearing the poet read his or her own poem, you still learn a whole lot of things about the poet and the poem. For example, you learn how the poet thinks the poem should be read. You may disagree with it, but certainly I think you learn that. You get a connection. It's a direct connection to the poet that you can't have on a page. You know, you get to hear the poet breathe and speak, and so you have a sort of embodiment, you know, of the poet coming directly to you. And you also can pick up sometimes some meanings that you might not have thought of, like when Ginsberg, for example, reads his poem America. I never thought of it as a funny poem. When I read it in school, I thought it was serious social controversy, and Ginsberg is just having a heyday with it, milking every double entendre, and the audience is on
mm-hmm.
the floor, and you know, I hadn't really seen it that way before, so sometimes that can be a revelation, too. I think it's fine to think, okay, this guy doesn't read as well as this guy, or to enjoy some poets more than others, but I also think that it's instructive to hear poets read their own work and entertaining.
Yeah. Well, we're here, right? We only have a couple minutes left. Maybe what we should do is finish with, we'll only be able to play part of this poem, I'm afraid, but Juan Felipe Herrera.
That's a good idea, yeah.
Because it's so different from what we've played so far.
Yeah, it has some music. It has a much more contemporary feel, and it's very performance-oriented.
Yeah, and it is musical. There is the guitar,
mm-hmm.
of course. But then also his voice and the Spanish
right.
flavor that comes through.
Juan Felipe thinks of himself as, he's a California poet who thinks of himself largely as a performance artist, And this is a subtle performance, but a delightful one.
Yeah.
About growing up Chicano in the San Francisco area.
Yeah, okay. Here it is. Logan Heights and the World.
From a neighborhood where you can see the bay from the kitchen. We kicked a highway patrol out from our barrio and put a Chicano park in its place. Right across the street from La Central, where I would buy tortillas and spy at the tripitas through the butcher's window, noting how they were braided. Imagine, braids on tripitas? I'd walk home, all the way on National Street, to a gray Victorian house next to a Spanish restaurant. The only Mexican joint calling itself Spanish in the whole area. How do you like that? El Porvenir, another tortilleria painted in turquoise, stood out on the corner. I played with my avocado green top. Anyway, I lived in apartment number 9. Every now and then I would go out with Jaime and Miguel Estrada, who knew how to part his hair. We would kick back at the Coronet Theater and look at the cool dude Pedro Infante and Maria Antonieta Pons and her hot legs while we spilled the salt and popcorn, 5 cents, on the floor. One time, I darted out into the street, making a liquor truck break every bottle as it slammed on the brakes. I was chasing Sammy Vasquez, the guy who wanted to dance with my girl, Mercedes Gomez, because she chose me and not him as a square dance partner in fifth grade. Yeah. A couple of years later.
Logan Heights and the World. That's an excerpt from that poem from Juan Felipe Herrera. And to you, Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thank you, Celeste. I enjoyed it.
Rebecca Presson Mosby has been our guest this afternoon. Her latest project is a box set of CDs featuring 98 poets reading their work. Poetry on Record. 98 poets read their work, 1888 to 2006. It is 1:52 Central Time, and settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, wow, and what another interesting day at the board. The numbers just seem to go all over the place. A big update. Lots of green in Chicago and in Kansas City as well. We'll start there, and then we'll talk a little bit about what happened in Chicago. Just a preview. Beans were up 9.